Hey, One Song listeners, Luxury here. What you're about to hear is the second part of our interview with the legendary songwriter and producer, Jimmy Jam. Now, if you didn't already hear part one, I highly recommend you go back and check out that episode first, because you'll hear Diallo and I talk with Mr. Jam about how he started working with Janet and how he and his production and songwriting partner, Terry Lewis, crafted her signature sound on the Control album. You'll also hear his thoughts on sampling and interpolation. Okay, here we go. You're listening to One Song, and this is part two of Janet Jackson's Control with our very special guest, Jimmy Jam.
Thanks to the U.S. Soy and the United Soybean Board for the sustainable makeover of our podcast studio and for sparking discussions on greener Hollywood production. Just like notes in a song, sustainable living is just a series of small, eco-friendly choices that contribute to the melody. Check out the Tears for Fears episode of One Song and see behind-the-scenes clips of how they pulled the whole look together. It's all on At Heartbeat Audio on YouTube, and the link is in our show notes.
Myrtle Beach is the beach. 60 miles of bright sand, water, and a wealth of wonderful music playing day and night. You can step into a simple beach bar and discover a surprising level of exciting musical talent. A place to kick back and groove to the enticing soundtrack of the most unexpected vacations around. With nothing but good vibes floating through the warm ocean air. Plan your own music-filled trip to America's Jukebox at visitmyrtlebeach.com.
There are so many classic tracks on Control. We thought we were narrowing it down. But I want to talk about Nasty.
Let's get into Nasty.
You know, to me, there are several iconic moments on this album. You know, Janet's line delivery and What Have You Done For Me Lately in the video, when she's like,
I know he used to do nice stuff for you, but what has he done for you lately?
There's is that no Janet who does that line?
No, yeah. That's her friend Melanie.
That's her friend Melanie?
That's Melanie that
okay,
says that.
Like, who was that actress?
I know he
where
used to do nice stuff
like,
for you.
But the way she says lately.
Oh, it was the
like,
best.
You can't think of that face without thinking of the way she says lately.
The
and
best.
Then, of course.
It's lateral movement.
No yeah, conversation. Yeah. Would be. I know we usually go like drums, synths in a certain order. I kind of want to. Can we do vocals first this time?
For you, Diallo, we'll do vocals. We'll
thank
do
you so
yeah,
much.
You're welcome.
So for this album, I mean, you can't talk about Nasty without the iconic line.
My first name ain't baby. It's Janet. Miss Jackson, if you're nasty.
Right. Who wrote that line? I mean, to me, it's a decade. Give it up for Jimmy Jam. But
thank
you said
you.
Terry Lewis is the lyric master, right?
Like, oh, he definitely is.
Yeah.
He definitely
before
is.
Before there was rhymingdictionary.com, he had rhyme schemes up here.
The thing that's great about Terry, and as you can tell, I'm a long-winded talker, but what takes me a paragraph to say Terry can say in a sentence, and that's what makes him such a great writer. I can go on. Yes, he's concise. That's exactly what he is.
I love it. Well, I want to, can we jump ahead to vocals? Because I think that this Nasty to me is defined by, there's so many great lyrics. We could yeah. unpack so much. What do you got for us, Luxury?
This, I have the most vocal chunks to play from this song, but this is by far the most like iconic in my mind, in our collective consciousness.
To this day, I don't eat nasty food. I just want to put that
okay.
out there. I
don't.
Yep. Those are the Nasty Boys.
Yep.
Okay, here we go. Miss Jackson, if you're nasty,
yeah.
a cappella.
Because privacy is my middle name. My last name is Control. No, my first name ain't baby. It's Janet. Miss Jackson, if you're nasty.
Now, when you hear her
she
say that in the booth.
So funky.
So good.
That is so funky. And that's exactly what I'm talking about. Her breaths mm-hmm. and all the little things that she does as she's singing just make that so funky.
That's also a Jackson thing, isn't it? Because the
it
acapella
is
from, like, I have a lot of Michael Jackson
yes.
jams. And he's doing all the... like,
yes.
He's doing that too. Is that
yes.
in the Jackson like jeans?
I just think it is. I never because we never worked with a
Joe.
I mean,
Joe would get on your case if you weren't breathing right at home. Like you had to be like, hey, can I get some butter?
Get on your case for
my toast. But, yeah. Like if you're like, can I get butter on my toast? You got. I don't want to make a joke.
You already
really
did.
Bad joke,
you already did.
A
dark place.
Clean,
you already did.
But yes, you know, I think yeah. you had to breathe in the Jackson.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I interrupted. Go ahead.
No, that was.
But no,
it.
She's got that. I mean. Like it's great when you can hear an acapella and still want to dance. Like,
yeah,
it's insane how good she is on that.
Yeah, I mean, listen to. I'm sorry. Play just that first line. I'm not a prude.
Okay.
I'm not a prude. I
yeah.
I want some respect.
Yeah. That's just...
I'm not a prude.
And people think... Right. And that was the thing. I remember people thinking that those songs were all really easy to sing.
Mm.
And then I'd hear people sing or try to sing them, and it'd be like, no,
that
you don't get
on
it.
Prude is really sad.
You're like, no, Pat Cuomo.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You ain't got it.
Yeah.
Pat Boone?
Yeah, Pat Boone.
Do you remember when she sang that, do you remember it going like, did you guys all know, like, this is the chunk. This is the part that people are going to remember.
Yeah, and the way we recorded, and once again, I mentioned earlier about Prince being so kind of spontaneous, and then Leon Silvers III being so, you know, anal, I guess I'll use, about
precise.
The vocal. Precise, thank you. precise about the vocals. So Janet was a great combination of that, because what we would do, in watching Leon in the studio, Leon Silvers III would literally take little, as the singer was singing, he would punch in and out on analog tape, which now digitally you can do it, but analog tape, he would do it to get a breath or to get a, you know, if the word is, you know, somebody says back at you, I'm going to get the cha of back at ya. Mm. And he would and I thought as a vocalist, that would drive me crazy because I'm singing the same thing over and over, but I have no idea what they're trying to get.
Mm.
So we kind of took a page from that book, and what we would do is we would let the singer sing the song 5, 6, 7, 8, 10 times, whatever it was. But in our minds and also on a sheet of paper, we would be making little marks of a certain word or a certain phrase or a certain breath or a certain little thing that we liked. And then we'd let the vocalist leave. And then we'd do what we called a comp track. And we put all the best elements from all those little pieces together on one track. And Janet, I have to say, was the funnest to do because there'd be, you know, little laughs or little little things
totally.
Like, or you know, like be all these little things that we could put in, almost the spices on the sauce.
I totally agree. I feel like I can't think of what song it is, but there's a song where like she literally like giggles, I think at the beginning of the track.
Yes,
and then the track starts. But like those like little inflections are, I mean, like people. I feel like there's still some people out there who don't understand the devotion that Janet Jackson fans have for Janet. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, it's understood right now, like, Taylor's that person. And,
yes.
You know, there have been times when Britney Spears was that person. Janet has those fans. Like, you know, and I think it's because so much of her personality bleeds into the song.
Yeah, the humanity of it was always really important.
It's more than just the song. You
it's
know what
more
I mean?
Than the song. It's really kind of her personality and those little things. And even things like I remember telling her, like on certain songs, if we were doing happy songs. And I would never look at her, but I would go, are you smiling? And she'd go, huh? And I'd go, are you smiling? And she'd be, what do you mean? I said, these are happy lyrics.
Yeah, it makes a difference. Right?
It makes a difference when you smile and sing.
You can hear it.
Yes. And so little things like that I always was aware of, and I think that was really important when we made the records, was if you were angry or if you were whatever, like put that thought in your mind and almost be the voice of people that can't maybe articulate it for themselves. You can be that voice for them, whether it's a love thing or a mean thing or a mad thing or a happy thing or whatever those things are.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know? Yeah, we talk about that a lot on the show, how like singing is, it's an acting job. And like to get the empathy from the listener, you really are putting on the character and the emotion that
absolutely.
You want to convey in the song with the lyrics.
And Janet was wonderful at that. But, you know, she had an actress background too.
Mm-hmm.
So some of that we were able to pull. And another thing on Control I'll just mention that was great timing-wise was we caught her at a point where she wasn't doing a million other things. She wasn't taping Fame. She wasn't doing a TV show or a movie or whatever. She literally had made up her own mind that she wanted to try singing. So she wasn't distracted. It was 100%, you know, for that, you know, 6 weeks or whatever it was. It was concentrated, and it was away from LA.
Mm-hmm.
It was in Minneapolis. So it was all about the studio, all about recording, and it was just... It just lined up perfectly.
I have to ask, since you mentioned Janet, are you smiling? Like when you have Janet in the studio, and I'm going to ask you to like put your brain where it was, you know, almost 40 years ago. Like you have her in the studio. Like, is she like, I always heard that Prince didn't want people looking at him when he was singing. I don't even know if that's true, but I've heard that. We know that Jay-Z doesn't take any, you know, he memorizes the lyrics, then he goes in and records it, you know, without any lyrics. What was Janet's thing? Did she have a thing in the studio?
Janet just liked it to be dark.
Mm-hmm.
She liked candles.
Okay.
But mostly dark. We kept everything really dark in the studio.
Yeah.
And I don't think she cared about being looked at. And a lot of times, I remember at that studio, because that was our first Flight Time studio when we recorded this, there was normally a music stand or there was something that was kind of blocking her anyway, so we really couldn't see her. But she was very comfortable. She didn't really have any, yeah. And there was nobody ever in the room, though, besides us. There wasn't even an engineer in the room. Steve Hodge, once again, who mixed the record, he wasn't even in the room with us. It was we set it up, and then we could just work.
It was intimate.
Totally.
It was intimate.
Totally.
We want to back up and do some drums here for Nasty, because to me, this song still feels very industrial. Mm-hmm. You know, like, at least it did to my ears back then.
Mm-hmm. And that's a perfect lead-in. I had a couple questions. So I'll just jump right into it. Nasty, by the way, second single off the album, and it was track two. It peaked at number 3 on the Hot 100, number 1 on the R&B charts, and it won Favorite Soul and R&B Single at the 1987 American Music Awards. So a lot of accolades for this one. So let's give me a beat, you say? Well, how about this one, Janet? What you're hearing those iconic percussion sounds, you know, we've got a kick and a snare, but the rest of what we're hearing is, I think it comes from the Insonic Mirage in Sonic, right? That was the sampler I understand you used.
It does, but it didn't.
Oh.
Oh, you thought you did your research.
Reveal the truth, Jimmy Jam. Don't hold back.
All the drum sounds are all Lindrum.
Okay. So that's
all
a
of those, everything that you just heard,
okay,
is all Lindrum.
It sounds like pots even, and pans.
Even the percussive, like, even the, here, I'll play it isolated. Yeah, yeah. This is that. Sure. This is the iconic Nasty sound. Lindrum. What are we hearing?
Lindrum.
That's Lindrum.
That's Lindrum.
Are some of those PROM, those presets, yes. Those ROMs,
yes.
Sounds that you just replaced.
Correct.
Interesting. Because I was going to ask, and Diallo alluded to it, when I hear this song, and let me just sort of step back for a second, across the song, you know, there's kind of no bass.
Right.
There's kind of, the only melodic elements appear to be coming from, and this, you're going to tell me whether this is a correct theory or not, but it reminds me of, you know, that like, you know, those old Casio samplers where you've got like, you know, dogs barking and you can do rough, rough, rough,
yes.
Rough, 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 rough.
Yes.
All the melodies appear to be kind of a sample where you've pitched it up and down. Mm. I'll play an example of it. This is ostensibly the bass line. Kind of the closest to the bass line. And that's interplaying with other sounds. But I hear this, and I hear kind of...
Are you feeling your own track right now?
Oh, yeah, that's... Yeah,
I love that. I love that.
I am. That's just so cool. So cool.
When I hear that, I hear some other stuff going on in the culture at the time. Like, I hear Art of Noise.
Mm-hmm.
I hear Close to the... I'll just play a little bit of that.
Trevor Horn.
Trevor Horn. One of my all-time favorites.
Oh, mine too. Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
And these are samplers that are playing, you know, car startup noises.
Yes.
And a little bit, and I think you just alluded to this a little bit, like a little bit Depeche Mode.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
All these industrial sounds.
Yes.
It was like the German dance scene at the time. By the way, Depeche Mode, the guy who wrote the songs was Half Black. I just want to point that out.
Martin Gore.
Because I make everything racial. So yes, Depeche Mode, kind of a black group. Anyway.
Yeah.
That's all. So I wanted to hear. This song has so much of what sounds like sort of. It's almost like it was an experiment. How much can we make without going to the Oberheim or without going to like a piano or guitar?
Mm-hmm.
Tell me a little bit about like. Was there a philosophy behind it, or did it just sort of end up that way?
So, I love industrial stuff. Like I always love that kind of stuff. So. The drum sounds were just kind of, you know, inspired by the noisiest noise we could make. That was kind of the idea of it.
Is that where the song began as a beat, where you're trying to do that?
I don't honestly remember. What I remember is getting the Mirage, the Insonique Mirage, as you say. With the French accent, but I remember getting
fancy.
I remember that. I remember getting that and going through floppy disks, And they had, a lot of them were split so that the top keyboard was something, the bottom keyboard was something.
The
right?
floppy disk had all the sounds on it because the keyboard didn't have anything in it.
No,
you had
it had
to put
nothing
a floppy disk
in it. It was all floppy disks. And I remember the initial set we got, and I still can't figure out, I know your listeners will be able to help me with this. I still can't figure out what the actual sound was called on the floppy disk, because it was one of the factory disks. And it had literally what the bass sound is mm-hmm. on the bottom hand, and it had the kind of fluty sound on the top hand.
Wow.
So I literally, when I put that in, I was always inspired by the sounds. And when I heard those two sounds together, I literally went boom, boom, gank.
That's crazy.
That's
that
so
was
cool.
It. It's not an accident that those sounds happen to both be
right.
on the song.
That's what I'm saying. That's why they're on the song, because
That's
it was
so
an upper
cool.
and a lower
same preset.
Keyboard thing.
It was wow. split.
Same too. Preset. Mm-hmm. And it was called, it was something with C's in it. It wasn't choir chamber, because there is a choir chamber.
Someone in the
wasn't
comments
that.
is gonna tell us.
Yeah, somebody will tell us. And
they're very helpful
I'll
in correcting us.
I'd love to know what that is. And I just, by the way, I just met, I can't remember his name now, but I just met the guy from Insonic at, it was the Grammy Museum, but I can't remember what the event was. But he said to me, he said, we used to send you Insonic stuff all the time. I said, I remember that. Because in Keyboard Magazine, I did an interview. And they said, what do you use? And I said, I use the Insonic Mirage. And everybody was like, you do? Because everybody at that point was either the emulators
the
or the Fairlights or the whatever. And I was like, hey, you can't afford that. You know, the Mirage was like, I don't know, $1,500 or something. It was like, oh, no, like, we used the Mirage.
It's affordable, yeah.
Yeah, and so that's what we ended up using. And after I said that, literally, we have a closet full at the studio of Insonic. Every possible keyboard they ever made, they sent to us.
They were
and
so
it
happy.
Was,
you sold
and
a bunch great. Of keyboards when you talked about
it. Oh, it was awesome.
Gave it a
They were really happy. But they said, yeah, nobody respects us and whatever, and you gave us, you know,
speaking of that flute sound, let's play that so that people can hear what you're talking about. So on the bottom half, on the bass in quotes, but it acts as bass. It's effective.
Yes.
And by the way, I had a quick question about that because, you know, absence of bass, we were talking about Prince before in Minneapolis. I mean, at this moment, we have When Doves Cry is already out there. I think Kiss hasn't come out yet.
That's a later.
But that idea of like drop not having bass content in a song was such an interesting notion. Was that also conceptually a goal for the song?
No, we didn't do it thinking that let's have a song without bass.
Okay.
Like that wasn't really the notion. It was just those two sounds together just sounded good.
They were enough
to fill out.
You didn't need anything more.
No. And one little, you know, asterisk or not asterisk, but a little note on that. We did go back on the remix, on the Cool Summer remix of Nasty, and had Terry put a bass part on it.
Yes.
Along
I have
with chords.
That. I have
right?
that.
And that version is the version that attracted George Michael to us, which allowed us to do Monkey. But that's a whole nother
thing.
Really
Monkey?
Really
I didn't even realize y'all had a connection to Monkey.
Yeah, we did that, yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. Sorry.
That was my favorite song on the album. And you know what's funny? I thought at the time, I was like, oh, George Michael did a almost hip-hop song.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah, that's another
I had
whole
no
other
story.
That's a whole other episode.
Yeah, no.
All right, so here is the other half of the keyboard, the top half. Jimmy's playing the bass in quotes on the low part, and this... And that's really it. You've just got two things happening outside of drums and vocals on the whole song. I'll play it contextually now, just so you can hear it in the mix. Mm-hmm. It really
just,
does sound
too,
like
yeah, it's just,
Martin
and the hardest
Gore
thing,
and Trevor Horn.
And in listening to that, I remember the hardest thing to do was, because I was playing it as it was being written, I'm playing with just, so I'm going, dun, 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 dun,
oh, you're playing both parts live.
I'm playing both parts live.
Wow.
But on the recording, because they needed to go on separate tracks,
I see.
I had to record them separately.
Did it feel weird to play?
Yeah, it felt weird. So literally, what I literally did was I had another keyboard. So I was playing, I was just, but it wasn't recording. So I was going, gong, gong.
That's like when you're recording drums and just the snare. And yes. You still got to do
you
something.
You still got to, yes. That's what it was.
Was Janet down for this really hard industrial sound, or did you have to convince her?
She was down with it. What I had to convince her about was when we gave her the lyrics and the melody, she said, she went in and started singing, and she said, sitting in the movie show, thinking that's the thoughts. So we said, no.
Like too high.
Too sweet.
Yeah, it's too sweet. I said, remember the other day, because she had a cold, as a matter of fact. And she said, remember when you had your cold and you were like, singing like that, and you were singing like that. Sing it like that. And she said, really? And we said, yeah. So then she did, sitting in the movie, in the low. And she didn't, when she left the studio, I remember she thought, this isn't going to work. And we said, no, come back tomorrow. We'll comp it and you'll hear it. And then I remember the next day when we comped it and played it back for her, she got this look on her face of just a total amazement. Like, was like, wow. And it's like, yeah. But it was a kind of a breakthrough, a bit of a breakthrough moment, because then it was like we had our trust. And so anything we asked her to do, no matter how crazy it was, she would just go, okay.
She knew it was going to sound good.
She knew, she trusted us. Yeah. And if it didn't sound good, we said, listen, nobody's going to hear it if it doesn't sound good. Of course, not knowing that stems would exist, because there's plenty of things out there that we never intended for anybody to hear, which, by the way, does bother me. But
we'll make sure that doesn't happen.
Yes. But there was a trust there, and that was important.
I will just say, as a writer, when you fight to get that actor and you fight so hard against, like, you know, the actor's instincts or the agent, like, this is not right for my client, and then you get them on set and you're like, you might still be going back and forth, but when they see the finished product.
Yep.
And then they call you up or they text you like, hey man, I finally saw the show. I finally saw, you know, that thing that you and Bashir wrote, and I love it.
Yes.
Like that, it's a whole different, like, you're like, because you're like, you didn't draw them into something that was going to hurt them or hurt their career.
And I'm also, struck by how the two of you, how you and Terry clearly, I mean, this is like pop psychology and I'm a musician, but like you clearly took on the role of sort of older brother figures that he could trust.
Yeah.
That she could trust, because she's like the younger sister with all of her Germaines and Titos, and
yes.
She's away from them, and you clearly fulfilled some psychologically, you built trust to become a bit like that for her.
Yeah.
A bit brotherly.
Yeah.
She's very beautiful.
I think so.
All right, well, funny how time flies when you're talking about this album, but let's wait a while, and when we get back, we're going to dive deeper into the making of Janet Jackson's Control when we get back.
Thanks to the U.S. Soy and the United Soybean Board for the sustainable makeover of our podcast studio and for sparking discussions on greener Hollywood production. Just like notes in a song, sustainable living is just a series of small, eco-friendly choices that contribute to the melody. Check out the Tears for Fears episode of One Song and see behind-the-scenes clips of how they pulled the whole look together. It's all on at Heartbeat Audio on YouTube, and the link is in our show notes.
Myrtle Beach is the beach. 60 miles of bright sand, water, and a wealth of wonderful music playing day and night. You can step into a simple beach bar and discover a surprising level of exciting musical talent. A place to kick back and groove to the enticing soundtrack of the most unexpected vacations around. With nothing but good vibes floating through the warm ocean air. Plan your own music-filled trip to America's jukebox at visitmyrtlebeach.com.
Hear that? It's the call of the Crave. And when the Crave calls, you know what to do. Try the $5 Bacon Bundle, because the only thing better than a White Castle slider is a White Castle slider topped with crispy hickory smoked bacon. So pick any two of either the Bacon Cheese Slider, 1921 Bacon Cheese Slider, or Chicken Bacon Ranch Slider, and also get a small fry for just $5 with the $5 Bacon Bundle. White Castle. Follow your Crave.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
So So there's one more thing I want to play for you and for everyone listening. This is, there's so many parts of Nasty, I could literally play the whole acapella, but this is one of my other favorite parts. It's the, hey, who's that singing part?
Hey, who's that thinking nasty thoughts?
Nasty boys!
Who's that in that nasty car?
Nasty boys!
Who's that eating that nasty food?
Nasty boys!
Maybe they're just poor boys.
Who's jamming to my nasty groove?
Ladies.
Oh, yeah, we got to get the ladies. Hold on.
Yeah, boys.
That's crucial.
Is that Melanie? Who's singing that? Is that Lisa Keith?
I think it's just Janet.
Oh, it's just Janet just doubled up?
I think so.
Yeah, we can't lose that. I get the whole stack because there's five parts coming in. All right, here we go. Or four parts coming in.
Ladies, nasty boys. I don't mean a thing.
Finger.
Nasty boys. Wait, you don't have that part?
Nasty boys.
No, there's a part. There's a part that's not played there. I mean,
oh, what's missing? Oh, I might have missed something.
Don't mean a thing. Oh, you. Oh, that's nasty
earlier.
Boys.
That's
you
earlier. Let's get that part. Yeah, I know
we
got exactly
some
what you mean.
People in the studio who are like, we clearly remember the video because you remember that like it was like the ladies' chorus
their
came
shoulders.
Out.
Shoulders are happening. Yeah. Here's the shoulders part.
Nasty boys. I don't mean a thing. Oh, you nasty boys. I don't mean a thing to me. Nasty.
Are y'all like completely straight faced when she
yeah,
goes nasty?
You guys are having
like,
fun doing
y'all
this.
Have to be like,
oh yeah,
got it.
Oh no, we were loving it. We were loving it. It was so good because it's once again it was trying to bring that attitude out that uh-huh. she had as a little kid. We always saw it as a little kid, and it was like, where's that attitude at? So we wanted to have tracks that brought that out.
This is bratty. This is like straight up little kid bratty.
It's bratty, right? But yeah. I got to say, this is the one place I'm going to take issue with you, Mr. Jam. And that is that...
okay, I'm
let's
ready.
Make sure
I'm not sure whose side I'm on.
I'm going to take an issue with you, Mr. Okay. Jam. Who's that eating that nasty food? They might have had poverty issues. Like, I don't know if that is part of being a nasty boy. I think that... we might have to give them a pass on that one. They might not have had control over their dietary.
That is true. However, if given a choice, they were eating the nasty food.
That's fair.
Maybe that's why they were the nasty boys.
You know, speaking.
What is the nasty boys side of this argument? But, that's what I want to hear. You know, like the movie Joker. The nasty boys deserve a song. I mean, they're probably nasty men, hopefully, by
now. By this point, yeah, sure. In their 60s.
Nasty grandpas, but... Oh, that was the sound of a million typewriters.
Comments.
I got my screenwriting.
Actually.
No, I think this is that's fantastic. I mean, like, I think you guys are so good with the harmonies. And I've heard you say elsewhere, like, you know, you were thinking about, like, America and some of these other, you know, 70s groups that did harmonies. My personal favorite off of this album is the line from What Have You Done For Me Lately when she says... now it seems those dancing feet are always on my couch.
Those notes,
that
melody,
modulation, or what is that called? What is that called? Where it's just
she's kind of becomes.
It seems those dancing feet are always on my couch.
It like, kind of goes from melodic to just talking.
But
if
it's
bit.
Also like it's the
no, it's
coming down the steps. Is
I literally
is it modulation?
Got,
what is that?
I don't know what it's called, but it goes down
it's
half
so
steps.
Good.
Yeah.
So I literally got asked about that. Totally not off the track, but we were rehearsing last week for our show,
mm-hmm.
and next to us was Lil Yachty. Who was it? Yeah, it might have been Lil Yachty. Was next door rehearsing. Mm. We were in Atlanta, and his band director is the same as Kendrick's, a guy named Chicago. We called him Chicago.
That makes sense because Lil Yachty put out one of the best albums of 2023.
Yeah,
and if you haven't heard it, go out and check it out.
Yeah, no, it's really good. It's so really anyway, good. He came over, and I think it was him that asked me that exact question.
Who
was
like, who
what
came
made
up
you
that?
Think of?
Like,
what do you think of that? I don't.
Is it,
I
a,
have
is
no
it a broken
clue.
Scale? What is it? Did you come up
yeah,
with?
Yeah, I did.
Terry?
I did, and I don't know.
Don't remember.
I don't remember what the thinking was.
Did it happen in the booth? Like it was an idea, like try this kind of thing, or had you played it on the keyboard as like a melody to be sung?
I think I did. The evidence would be on my vocal track. Unfortunately, I probably sang it like that as like a guide. Okay. And I think that's probably why it ended up like that. But I don't know what, I don't know why I thought of that. I really don't.
I mean, that's a totally legit question. I think some of it probably comes from the fact that you guys were playing 12-minute performances and then just cutting it down. I always say, you know, one of the best key solos of all time, easily, is "I Didn't Mean to Turn You On," Sherelle, because it's got that, like it hits that one note towards the end of the solo. Yep. Is that you? Is that?
No, that's actually Monty Moyer. I believe.
From the time.
Okay, yes. So to bring it back to Control, yeah. I think I did not know this man's name until we started preparing for this episode. Mm-hmm. I admit, I didn't know he was the guy on the album cover of the time.
Yes,
and shout out to him because Pleasure Principle.
Yes,
an amazing iconic video and just a really great song.
Yep,
it's
amazing.
It's his contribution to Control.
Yep.
I'm sure you guys were excited to have that song on the album because you guys seem gracious. You don't seem like, oh, well, that ain't one of our songs. Like, that can be a B-side. Like, it seems like you guys were like,
no, Monty
he's
was
got
part
a great
of the team.
Song here.
No, Monty was part of the team. Mm-hmm. He was part of the Flight Time team. When Prince fired us, Monty quit. When we got fired, he quit to join us. He was part of the flight time team.
The flight time team, it's like the writer's room on Sid Caesar when you hear about all the writers who came out of the Sid Caesar writer room or all the writers who came out of the the Larry Sanders show.
Yes. Uh-huh.
You know, Steve Levitan and you know, all these other people. Like there's certain collections of people that you look back in time and like everybody in that room was a killer.
Yes.
You know, everybody in that room was hot.
Yeah.
I gotta ask you, because you've said a couple of times about Prince. You know, the firing. To me, the most interesting part of that story is that apparently he called Terry and offered him the chance to come back. You know, but you couldn't come back, and that hits home for me because I'm part of a writing team, and Bashir Salahuddin and I have done a lot of TV together, and we've worked together for 15 years.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I come to this podcast as a guy who's primarily known as a comedy writer and actor, as opposed to Luxury, who's a music performer. I say all that just to say there have definitely been times that we've worked with people who got along more with one of us than the other.
Yeah.
You know, and there was definitely one time, and I can't say his name because he's still super duper famous. I don't even know if I want to say if he's in the music field or in the comedy field, but... you know, to this day, we sort of laugh because we're like, that dude really tried to break up the team. Like, you know, he tried to sort of play favorites and sort of be like, hey, you know, you're the funny one. You know, like, it's the same way. Like, I feel weird sometimes even asking you, oh, was that you or was that Terry?
Right.
Because ultimately, it came out of the same kitchen. Like, I love how gracious you are to Terry, and I feel like Terry's got to be gracious to you. I think that's the only way a team works, because if you're at all open to the idea of somebody coming in and saying, you're the special one, it can be broken up 18 ways.
Sure.
There have been people who preferred me over Bashir. There have been people who preferred Bashir over me. And most people that we really get along with sort of understand there's sort of an unseen cooking and recipe that's going on. You know?
And that's exactly what it is. I mean, there's people that you could ask different artists. You could ask Janet, and you could say to Janet, who does what? Mm-hmm. And she could go, well, you know, Jimmy does most of the stuff. Terry's around, but he does some of the lyrics, blah, 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 blah. And then you could ask Usher, and Usher would go, I never see Jimmy. I know he's around, but, you know, like literally we each have our own relationships mm-hmm. with people. And at the end of the day, it was interesting watching the Beatles documentary because I always just assumed Lennon and McCartney were joined at the hip and everything they did was together.
Yeah.
But there's songs that were 100% Lennon's and songs that were 100% McCartney's. At the end of the day, it was Lennon and McCartney.
Yeah.
That's the way Jam and Lewis are. Yeah. There's songs that are 100% mine. There's songs that are 100% Terry's. But we have a 50-50 handshake agreement that we did back in 1982.
Which is so powerful.
And we just... That's what it is. Right. So even if I've never heard, there's songs that I literally would come out, I'd hear them on the radio, and I go, Terry, when'd you do that? And he'd go, oh, I did that last week, you know, what or whatever. And it'd be like, but I got 50% of it. So it takes away all of the things that you would ever nitpick about creatively.
Mm.
Like, that's my chorus. Well, that's my verse. Well, that was my title. Well, that's
there's
my
no
melody.
There's no way to work like that.
You can't, no, because then you're trying to nickel and dime, and that's not what it is.
And I'd even ask, and this is a question, because I feel like, you know, Luxury and I have a partnership.
Uh-huh.
Bashir and I have a partnership. Every partnership is a little bit different. Did you guys fight like brothers, Like, were you guys ever like at a total impasse where like one of us was like, hey, look, this is more my project than yours. I gotta make sure it's this. Or
no.
was it never contentious.
Never
in
contentious.
40 something years.
No, never contentious. Well, 50 years now. 50 years this year.
Wow.
June 17th, 1973.
Happy birthday.
That's the day we met.
Happy birthday.
Thank you. So we, I make the distinction. It's a subtle distinction. And I think I said it at the Rock Hall. We've never had an argument, because an argument is something you're trying to win.
Mm.
And I never want to win at something that my partner is losing.
Wow.
Because if I win an argument against him, that means he lost an argument. So that's not right. We do have disagreements.
Mm-hmm.
A disagreement is something you're trying to solve. And that's the way we put it. So it's like the best way should win. Not whether it's my way or your way. What's the best way?
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way we look at it. So we have disagreements. But never arguments. And as far as we naturally gravitate, Terry in a lot of ways on Janet stepped away from it because he knew we would be working on something and then they got it. And he's got other things to do. So he would step away from that and allow that to happen. And then when we would need him for something like, you know, we need a lyric idea for whatever. And Terry would be like, oh, I got it. And just like do it, you know, like have it. So that was the way we always worked together. And then, like I say, another
strengths and like not needing to be a part of every single
and,
thing.
And same even with Usher. Crucial. It was funny. Usher, I remember there was a song with Usher that Usher was like, Terry, I need Jam to write me this song that's like blah, blah, blah. And Terry was like, yeah, you got it. I'll tell him whatever. And I did, and I came up with the song, and Usher loved it. He was like, oh, my God, this is great. And it's like, well, yeah, all you have to do is ask. I mean, I'm here. I mean, it's not like I'm not here. But, yeah, there's certain people you would ask, and you go, oh, Jimmy does everything. I don't know what Terry does. And people that would go, Terry does everything. I don't know what Jimmy does. I never see him. So,
stress enough. It's obviously, we are not at your level, but when Bashir and I work, like, there's times when I'm in one writer's room and he's in another writer's room. And we'll literally confer at the end of the night or, like, you know, maybe on set, maybe in the editing.
Yes.
After it's all done, like, you know, I'm sitting there like, was that the best take that we got for the? Okay, so why don't we just change the storyline in the scene? Like, there's all kinds of stuff that goes on behind the scenes that people don't ever see. And I think that's so crucial. I want to ask one more question before we move on about the Prince firing. This is my own controversial take.
Okay.
This is my controversial take.
Controversy.
And I say it as a Prince fan. I say it as a Prince fan. I feel like Prince was driving the culture, you know, throughout the 80s in just a real way. And I feel like after probably Diamonds and Pearls, there's a period where he's not driving the culture and hip hop has come on and hip hop is sort of the dominant drive, like driving the culture.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know at what point, did you ever work with Prince again after the fire? Like, did you guys work on any of the later stuff?
Well, we never worked directly with him. Yeah. Although when we did the Pandemonium album,
right,
we basically took tracks that were started back in the Prince days of the 80s, like the late 80s, early 80s, and we'd worked on
this
those.
This goes to my point, and this is my I'm not asking you to sign off on it at all, but I'm always like, how could Prince have stayed more in the center of the culture? Because you guys stay in the center of the culture, literally from the SOS band, you know, into the 2000s, like you guys are at the center of the culture in ways that, quite frankly, again, I say this as a Prince fan, he was not. My hot take is that if he had not fired you, had sort of let you guys grow and then circled back to you and been like, you know, Jimmy, Terry, let's get in the studio. You know, like, I think he would have stayed more on the scene. I think, you know, like, cause, you know, I went to a Prince concert in 1998. Like, you know, it wasn't the hot ticket in town by that point.
Sure.
And I just feel like he could have used y'all, you know, in some of those, you know, in the 90s and in the 2000s. I think
there's so many things there. The one I will say this, Terry always used to tease Prince all the time, and he used to say that he always used to tell Prince, produce a record that doesn't sound like you.
Mm.
Prince was so kind of singular in what he did that it was hard to get out of what he did. And he was so good at it, if that makes sense.
Of course.
So I think that was part of it.
He was masterful at it.
He was masterful at it.
And I think about the Bat Dance album. I'm like, I love the Bat Dance album.
Yeah.
If Jimmy and Terry had been on the Bat Dance album, it would be up there with Purple Rain. That's my own personal I love those songs, but like I just feel like there is something that's missing, and it's almost like he's trying to, at that point, chase your sound a little bit. I don't know.
Well,
I'm not trying to cause any ruckus, you guys.
No, there's no ruckus. And at one point, you know, at one point we did, unfortunately, he passed, but he came to us and he said, if you produced an album on me, what would you do? And we said, well, we'd go back, we'd go in the vault, and we grab all that stuff from the 80s, from the early 80s that's sitting around, and we'd start there, and then we'd make a record. And he was like, great. Let's do that. So he wanted us to produce it.
Yeah.
So he did come back around to that, which was great. And our relationship at the end with him was wonderful.
It was great.
Yeah, it was wonderful. But yes,
That's the movie that Hollywood honestly needs to make. I don't know how. I think you can make it. It's not like, you know, there's certain stories that Hollywood wants to make, but like there might be bullets flying on set if you really tell the truth. I don't think that's the case with Flight Time and Prince and the Revolution and everybody else from Minneapolis. I would love to see that story be told.
Some of the people, I will say, there was definitely, because we music directed the Prince special that the Grammys did three years ago.
Yes, I remember, yeah.
And there was a lot of PTSD with a lot of the people.
I bet.
That had stuck around and had a lot of bitterness and a lot of stuff. I mean, we got out unscathed because he basically pushed us out the nest and told us to fly.
Yeah.
Terry always called it freed. He said he didn't fire us, he freed us.
Right.
That's what he said. But he was very much, Prince held on very closely to the people who he really wanted to be there.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was probably a little codependency because I think he felt like these people need to be with me to excel. And I need them with me to excel.
To excel.
He didn't feel that about us.
But Prince's fatal flaw seems to be his need for control, like getting back to this album. Like that word seems to define everything. All the stories are about he needs to be controlling every detail.
Absolutely
does. Including what you do and what you don't do and when you do it and when you don't do it.
Absolutely.
And that,
but he's good. He's good at doing it.
Yeah.
But sometimes you have to let people... you have to let people go. You have to let people... I always said... it was funny because somebody asked about Motown, or people always mention Motown, and they go... there'll never be another Motown. And I said, I agree. There will never be another Motown. But I think the closest thing that could have maybe happened would have been if we would have done what we did under Prince's...
At Paisley Park. Yeah.
If he had been a different kind of leader.
If he would have just said, you guys, whatever you guys want to do, you can do it. Just do it under this. And so now everything that we do is Paisley Park. So now Janet and New Edition and Mary J. Blige and everything that we do now is all in the
that
Paisley.
That would have been absolutely.
Yeah. That would have been amazing. And we would have loved that. And the Prince records, like you mentioned, would have been, I think, a lot cooler.
Well, we're going to get back into Control. And this was the fourth single. Don't you miss when albums had so many singles?
There were seven singles from this so album, ultimately. Isn't that insane?
I love it when you read a track list, you're like, these were all singles. The fourth single, came out on October 17th, 1986.
Yeah.
It's actually track number one on the album.
Right.
And I believe you've got some parts to play.
You know what I've got right here? I've got the stems.
Yes, sir.
So let's listen to them. All right. The beats on Control. I wanted to ask you a little bit about, we were talking about Minneapolis, the Minneapolis sound. We were talking about Sherelle. Mm-hmm. Didn't Mean to Turn You On is one of my all-time favorite songs.
Mm-hmm.
Something was happening in that moment in music. And with I guess, funk and electronic funk, or boogie maybe is a better way to put it, with how the bass lines and everything. But drum machines, there was almost a separation in what the kick and snare were doing and what the hi-hats were doing. Mm-hmm. It almost sounded like two different performances because you'd have these crazy like 30-second note, like it's almost like what drill or trap would be now with the hi-hats. So I'm going to play the beat. And another thing about this song, which is unique about on the album, is that 13 of the 24 tracks are percussion and rhythm and drums.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot going on here rhythmically. I really want to get into that with you. But let's listen first, and we'll build it starting from the ground up. I love that clap by itself. So satisfying.
That's the, you know, the...
Yeah, that giant reverb.
That became L.A. and Babyface's... trademark.
I can see that. Yeah.
Yeah, they did. I remember asking them about that and they said, "Oh yeah, we got that from Control."
we took that from you.
Yeah.
We got that from this.
Yep. Okay. Exactly. Yeah.
Well, we're going to build now. We got another layer going on top of that. There's those
Is that cowbell?
Cowbell.
Yep. I'll play it by itself because it's fun to hear that, the high stuff there. A little tambourine in there too.
Mm-hmm.
Snap.
Yep.
And then last we have...
Funky.
It's so funky. But it's 13 things.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have bongos, percussion, some more toms.
The ping and zing track, as we call it.
Okay, and I'm going to build it back. So I feel like you had a lot of fun building this track.
Mm-hmm.
Is this a Lindrum situation?
Lindrum situation.
Okay, and talk about the day you made the beat, or if you can remember, like, kind of what was going through your mind as you were making this.
The funny thing is, we still have the drum machine that all that stuff was done on. I mean, we still have everything that all this stuff was done on. And I looked at that machine the other day, yesterday, as a matter of fact, and it looks like a different machine to me than it looked, you know, almost 40 years ago. Like it's a different thing, because a lot of it was, I don't know whether it's ignorance, but I didn't know necessarily what I was doing on it. I just knew, as being a drummer, there were just certain things that I just wanted to try to get out of it. And the changes and the different, like, little combinations of things. I don't know. I just felt like you could build a song from a beat, which wasn't necessarily always the way. I mean, a lot of songs start off with chords and that, and then you put a beat on it. This was a case of actually doing the beat first and then figuring out musically what it should be.
Oh, wow.
So,
okay.
So it was just kind of a different way of working, and that to me was what drum machines allowed, those tools allowed us to
do. You might have just answered, like, my next question, because I was going to ask you about, there's a very famous drum break in this song, which is Crazy Town. As a drummer myself, I still have to go back and replay it to count, like,
yes.
I get lost. I'm going to play it for you. This happens... The weird break is at 4:58. I'll play it in the actual song so you can hear it in context, because otherwise your brain's going to get real messed up. So this is Control, the weird drum break. Everyone count. 3, 2.
Yeah, I mean, like, I'm a drummer. Even I can't find. Even I got lost there. I was like, oh, is it coming back? And that is so good call.
What the hell is that, dude? You built this from the ground up, and you're like, yeah, we're keeping that. We're going to build on top, and everyone's going to know what's going on. You're not, what the hell? I
was
love
that
it.
So that the club would actually just stop and be like, what's going on?
No, it was that we always wanted to have drama and emotion and dynamics.
Mm-hmm.
We just always wanted those elements in songs. So we weren't purposely trying to do something off, but it literally was, you know, if you count it, it still lines up. But it was just, I don't know, it was just ka-da-boom,
ka-da-boom. So you performed that? There was a beat?
Yeah.
There's like something was programmed, and on top of it, you kind of added.
Yeah, some of it. That actually ended up being programmed like that. I performed it, but I recorded the performance of it, if that makes sense. And so as the song would go, all I would do is just switch sequences, if that makes sense.
Like different patterns.
Different patterns. I would just switch patterns.
Yeah.
And that was the other thing. A lot of times I didn't know. I would try to kind of count, like, to be on an even number of measures or whatever. But a lot of times I wouldn't know.
Okay.
So that's why sometimes changes would happen, you know,
but
on
you
an
left
odd
it in,
thing
and it's
or
one
whatever.
Of the best parts of the song.
Yeah, yeah, that's kind of that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And then I remember even on the choruses of the song, on the Control, there's a snare drum that happens on the 2 and the 4. That was never programmed in there like that. So I'm playing those live.
Mm-hmm.
So they're kind of, they're a little off.
Perfect.
They're a little,
okay.
A little glitchy. But we always wanted to do that. And then I mentioned pings and zings. We always put, like, I hear the vibra slap in there, or and you know, you hear the like the and you hear like stuff like that. We always did live percussion, even with the drum machine stuff, to keep it,
keep
you know,
human.
A human element to it, and also live cymbals too. Always did that.
The bass line for this is one of my favorite bass lines on the album, and bass sounds, I should
bass,
say,
yeah,
because it is so nasty.
Mirage.
This is the Mirage bass. I couldn't help
but
my face.
I feel like y'all are
getting
the ugly face.
You got to get the ugly face.
I feel like Seinfeld heard that, and he was like, I need that. give me that track.
It's very bing, 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 bing.
Give me the track.
And in the mix, you know. What? This is like a high point of American culture right here, is this snippet right there.
Yeah.
I love that part.
Thank you.
Vocals. I mean, like, should we hear the bridge? We haven't heard. You guys are masters when it comes to a bridge. Yeah, got my own life. I'm going to make my own decisions. I mean, you can hear me sing that. But why don't we hear Janet sing the bridge?
Got my own mind. I want to make my own decisions. It has to do with my life, my life. I want to be the one in control.
So that's you going, did it, like, did it, did it.
Yeah, yep. The other thing I noticed, too, in all the vocals, you hear, you know, the headphones are so loud.
The bleed.
Yeah, the headphone bleed. Yeah, she loved the headphones, like, super loud.
Yeah.
We'd always
She's
be fighting that.
Yeah.
We'd always be fighting that on the mixes, but...
We only have so much time, unfortunately, when we do this show. So we aren't going to do any deep dive on the stems of Pleasure Principle, Let's Wait a While, which is like such a fantastic, epic, iconic slow jam. Funny How Time Flies, which was, you know, I love that song, but then it's also got a second part in my brain from when the Lost Boys sampled it for, I think it was the song was Renee,
yeah.
which is a mm-hmm. great, great hip-hop track from the 90s.
Every day. Renee. Here's a tune about this honey named Renee that I met one day on my way back from John Jay.
We would love to talk about every song on this album, like I said, but we really only have time enough to talk about one more. And we have to talk about this one because it was your first number one Hot 100 single. And that's like huge. I mean, like, luxury.
And it was Janet's first number one too. It was Janet's.
Yeah.
It was Janet's first number one. It's Jimmy and Terry's first of 16 number one singles. I lied when I said we weren't going to talk about your 16 because you've had 16 number one singles, my friend.
That's hilarious. It's When I Think of You.
Quick question. I read somewhere where this song was inspired by Casey and the Sunshine Band.
That's
is that
crazy.
True? What's very
true. What's the story there?
Very true. I'm a huge Casey and the Sunshine Band fan.
Yeah.
I think their rhythm section was probably one of the greatest rhythm sections and actually is the, I would call it the foundation of New Jack Swing.
Wow. What? I can almost see it.
Well, I actually interviewed Teddy Riley for my show. And I asked him that. I said, that was my theory. And he said, why do you think that? And I said, so the song I Get Lifted.
Yes. Which is a cover.
Yeah, George McRae.
Yeah, George McRae did it first.
But Casey and the Sunshine Band produced it and wrote it.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yes. So when you hear on all of Teddy Riley's stuff, right?
Yeah.
Right? I said, so my thing is, I think that was the foundation. And he laughed and he said, okay, you know what's even crazier? He said, what was my first big hit? And I said, I Want Her. Key Sweat, right? The bass line. Boom, boom. Boom, boom,
no
boom,
way.
Boom. That's the way I like it. Casey and the Sunshine Band.
That is not an accident. Wow.
Yeah.
Those songs still hit every now and then.
Oh,
I've
man.
Never
Casey
noticed
and the Sunshine Band, I'm telling you.
I just dollar bin bought that George McRae record literally a couple months ago.
Yeah.
Like, so good.
It's so good.
It's so good.
But Casey and Rick Finch is his partner, writing partner, the production partner. Amazing. And the guitar player, I can't remember his name, but the guitar player on that, the secret of those records to me was the guitar player. Because if the drum beat and the bass lines were the simplest bass lines you could ever write. It was very cool in the gang is what it was.
Yeah.
Right? It was just the simplest bass lines. But listen to, I Like to Do It, listen to, I'm trying to think, the beginning of I'm Your Boogeyman before the song actually kicks in.
Wow. Okay.
Listen to the guitar riff.
Oh, man, I can't wait to hear it.
Maybe we can play a little snippet of that for the listeners right now.
It's like crazy.
And it's got a little bit of that swing to it.
It's totally got, it's this thing. So my thing on When I Think of You was that same kind of feel because simple bass line, boom, 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 boom. And everybody always said, tighten up. And I said, no, it's not tighten up. That wasn't the, because I love Tighten Up, Archie Bell and the Drum.
Right. Yeah.
I love that song, but that wasn't the thing. It was literally Casey and the Sunshine Band. It was that kind of feel that those records gave you. It was just very kind of a floating.
Sunshine.
Yeah, sunshine, happy.
But to the New Jack Swing feel specifically, there's a little bit of a pause before, like a little bit of a ding, ding, ding. It's not quite jazz, but like that's what that is. It's not straight eighths,
exactly.
Right? Just a little bit of a
swing. Yeah, a little bit of that, for sure. And I asked Teddy, was he influenced at all by Nasty? Because to me, Nasty was the first New Jack Swing song, just in my opinion. Not necessarily New Jack Swing song, but the first one to kind of have that kind of upbeat thing.
You'll be glad to know there's a musicologist on Wikipedia who agrees with you.
Yeah.
Okay. No, you always want to have the musicologist vote.
Yeah, when the musicologist signs
in. That's not for the Grammys.
It's
for the nerds.
But no, but he said he wasn't. He said that didn't really. But I remember being, sorry to go off. I remember being with Babyface in L.A. at this club called Carlos and Charlie's. And I Want Her came on, and I remember I said, ooh, what is this? Because the little reminded me of Nasty, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think LA said, oh, it's Keith Sweat. And I said, oh yeah, Keith Sweat. I said, oh yeah.
Keith Sweat, the stockbroker?
Yeah. Right. I said, this is cool. And then Babyface said, no, the dude that did the record, Teddy Riley, you got to check him out. And I said, oh, Teddy Riley. And that was, so Babyface was the first one that said the name Teddy Riley to me. Mm. And I've been a fan ever since.
There you go.
So
that's awesome.
Let's hear some sense from the song that the Jacksons themselves knew would be the biggest hit.
They knew it.
You played this song, you played the whole album?
I played the whole album for them, and they all said, what's that one song? And I'm like going, Nasty?
Yeah.
No. What have you done for me lately? No. Pleasure Principle? No. I said, what song are you talking about? The song with the piano in it. I said, oh, When I Think of You, that's going to be number one.
Play this part till the end. So those Mirage horns, those are samples, obviously, right? Those hits, those horn hits are samples.
Yeah, sampled from floppy disk Mirage.
Yep.
Literally, the piano sound, the horn hits. Yep. The little marimba sound is DX7.
DX7.
And the bass line is DX7.
And then there's also some guitar. Terry plays guitar on this
Terry plays guitar on it because we didn't have a guitar player. We couldn't find a guitar player and we needed to finish the song.
You're still looking for the female guitar player, sounds like.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
But I don't think this entire part that is in the stem is what's used. I think some parts are muted, right? So when I play this.
Yeah. I mean, that's very.
So here's the remix, the live remix on the fly. And if you really want those 808s. But that didn't exist, those 808s, you were saying.
No, we put that in. We did that for the single. So when on the single, we wanted to spice it up a little bit because Radio had already played. Well, the Radio had already played it a ton.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, you know, we were just like, let's put it. And then we did a different intro because we started with the 808 on the remix.
Mm-hmm.
Started with the 808 and then we had this little bell line that went boom, 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 boom.
Yeah.
Remember that?
Yeah.
So that's what we did, just to have something a little special, you know, for Radio to play, so it didn't burn out, you know.
It wouldn't be a conversation about Control if we didn't hear a little bit more of Janet's vocals.
Let's hear
some Janet on When I Think of You.
Anytime my world gets crazy, all I have to do to calm it is just think of you.
Such a great delivery too. She seems so confident. I also love this big harmony stack that I love to build harmony stacks. So let's do that. You gotta listen to this part. What's going on here?
Oh, we're all just standing around the mic, I think.
Is this like Fat Boys? Like, are you beatboxing?
Right.
But here's the best part coming up. Okay, I got a question. We're gonna talk about the blap, and you know we're gonna talk about the blap.
What's the blap?
Something happened because all of a sudden we hear this. What's going on here?
That's the laugh I was thinking about, though, when I was talking about you hear laughter on her.
Oh,
on her,
totally.
On her songs. I'll play the whole thing through. Sorry.
I don't know.
Feels so good.
Did somebody just like go boo or something? It seems like a very genuine like blap,
But I don't remember. I honestly don't remember. Wow. But I mean,
it's cool.
Is that that's is her singing? It's a
blap. I know the laughing's in the mix. Is that?
Oh yeah, the yeah. The
blap's in the mix.
Okay. Yes. Yeah, so, oh yeah, it's totally there.
Okay.
Totally there, but I can't remember
what happened.
What it was.
And this is her doing it, right? Or is that somebody else? Like kind of sneaking up to the microphone and going blap. We don't know.
Wow. Yeah, that one's going to, we're going to have to come back for another episode.
We need Robert to figure that out.
We need the mentalist.
Jeez. Wow. That's interesting. I'll have to, and I
stumped Jimmy Jam.
I know I'm going to talk to her today, so I'm gonna ask her.
You're going to ask Janet today?
Remember. I'm going to ask Terry, too.
Okay.
Will you tell them hello from us?
Yes, please
absolutely
say hi.
Will.
Hi, guys.
Absolutely will.
Just be like, hey, these are two nerds that I don't know their names.
By the way, you told me I sound like Obama.
You do.
You sound like Questlove.
Man.
Wow.
This interview's over. It's been nice having you, Jimmy Jam.
I got one last. I have one more question, and this could be a mystery, but this is an you know, some of these stems say, you know, Jimmy did this, Terry did
this.
Who is this low male vocal? Is this you or is this Terry?
Because when I think of you.
Terry.
That's Terry.
Absolutely.
Baby.
Mr. Background, we used to call him.
Because he's in the mix.
Yes.
When I think of you, baby.
So beautiful.
All I think about is a remix of this. This would be so, with his vocals up here and her supporting, like, that's kind of a different song. And it makes me think, like, you should, you know,
totally,
do a remix.
Yeah, definitely a totally different song.
So fun. This song is so fun.
Terry's, I always called him Mr. Background because he could blend with anybody. Like, wow. A lot of the, like, I'll tell you, the background vocals on Humanly?
On Humanly?
That's him.
Ooh, Human. Oh, that's no Terry. Way. Yeah, he just had a very
and apparently it's not any of the girls from the
It's not the other girls. Who's that other girl on the track?
I love that. Do you want to just quickly tell that story? It's such a satisfying story.
Oh no, when we were doing Human, Terry worked with Phil Oakey, the lead singer, for like 6 days to get that vocal. Like he really worked hard to get the lead vocal. So when we did the backgrounds, we used a combination of Terry and Lisa Keith, who was like our secret weapon background singer for everything. And when they heard the song, the girl said, "Who's that other girl on the track?" And we said, "That's Lisa Keith. She's a background singer. I don't think we like that other girl on the track." Mm. So the next day, Phil was seeing, I think it was Joanne.
Dating Joanne, yeah, I think.
So anyway, the next day he comes back to the studio. He walks in the room and he goes, "I just have to say, we don't like that other girl on the track." And we looked at him like, "Huh? I just have to say, we don't like that other girl on the track."
Is he kind of winking? I just have to.
He's not actually winking, but he's just kind of standing there very stiffly, like delivering a line. And after about the third time he said it, we said, "Oh, you just have to say, we don't like the girl on the track." And he said, "Yes, I just have to say." We said, we get it. Okay, cool. And we called A&M and we just said, "Hey, we're taking the song off the record." And they said, "What are you talking about? It's a single." We said, "No, either we finish it the way we want to finish it or we're just going to take
it." That's crazy because you have the first number one single in your lives and then 5 weeks later with the Janet, with When I Think of You, and 5 weeks later, Human by the Human League is your second number one single.
Yeah.
And then we're not going to talk about how you have 14 more number one singles after that.
Okay.
I'm just not going to bring that up.
Okay. I know. That's okay. Unfortunately, we are coming to the end of the episode. And there are a few more things that we'd love to ask you about Control, but I think what we're going to do is we're going to basically say, I think if you can, share with us how you feel like this album in particular did change your life.
Wow. It was a total life changer, certainly because of the success after the fact.
Mm-hmm.
But also because it was a proof and concept of a whole lot of things. One was moving to Minneapolis to do our studio up there rather than staying in LA.
Yeah.
The concept of working to getting to know what the artist wanted to say rather than just giving preconceived notions to them. So I think that was part of it too. Us as engineers at this point, because we basically engineered that record. We had an engineer walk out on us on the album before we did, which the one with Saturday Love, the Sherelle record. And
he walked out.
Yeah, we had an engineer walk out in a disagreement. And so we had to learn how to run our wow. studio. And it wasn't a laptop. It was like studio with tapes and patch bays mm-hmm. and all kinds of crazy stuff. So anyway, when we recorded that record, we actually recorded Control way too loud because we didn't know. Mm-hmm. And so when Steve Hodge came up to mix it, he said, "Who recorded this?" And we were all proud. Oh, we did. He said, "It's way too loud." And we said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Everything's in the red." And we said, "Yeah, that's the way Prince did it, you know." And he said, "Yeah, but Prince's machines were set up where zero meant zero on the VU meter. Mm-hmm. Your machines are set up where zero is plus six, so you're already plus six at zero.
Already. Before I even get to
the Yeah, and we said, "Well, can you save it?" And he said, "Yeah, it'll be fine." He said, "But the next album, I'm going to teach you guys how to record. I'm going to come up and teach you guys how to record." And the next album was Human League.
Oh, wow.
The next album was Human League. So, yeah. But anyway, so for a lot of reasons, yes, Control was life-changing, obviously a lifetime friendship with Janet. She's godmother to my oldest born son. We're just, you know, we're as close as we can possibly be, way beyond work.
And I think that's a testament, groundbreaking for sure. That just goes to show, I think, you know, just being in the room with you today, if it's not coming through to the listeners, you know, just you get the sense it's just a good person. You get the sense, I think the word you used was humble.
Yeah, generosity, too. I feel a lot of generosity.
Much generosity. Yeah. And, you know, we've been in some rarefied spaces. We've been around some unique, very, very talented but difficult individuals. You are not that. You just seem to be just this really gifted, amazing, talented person who also happens to be like a sincerely cool guy. So we can't thank you enough, sir, for coming through the podcast today.
Thank you for having me. And I'll say thank you for having me, uh-huh. and then you can edit it. Stop it. But I will say that when we were working with Michael Jackson, I remember Michael said to me, he said, "How do you want to be remembered?" And I said, I thought about it for a second, and I said, "I want to be remembered as a nice guy." And he said, no. For all your number one records or your, you know, all your hits. And I said, "No, I just want to be remembered as a nice guy." No. For your, you know, this and that. And I said, "No." I said, "Listen, Michael, that's all statistics stuff." I said, "That doesn't mean anything to me. I mean, that's cool, but it doesn't really mean anything." He didn't get it. So fast forward about a year later, we had sampled, I think, Billie Jean or something for something. And they said, "You'll never get it cleared. It'll never get cleared." And we were like, "Okay, cool." So anyway, I called Michael and I just said, and it was funny because I remember my office, there was a girl, Sue, that worked for us. And Sue never came back to my office. She always would just sit up front and just intercom, right? She comes back to my office. She goes, "Michael Jackson's on the phone." I said, "Okay." And she says, "No, Michael Jackson's on the phone." I said, "Yeah, I heard you." She said, no, not somebody calling for Michael Jackson. "Michael Jackson's on the phone." I said, "I got it, Sue. I got it right. Michael, how you doing?" Great. He said, "I know you want to ask me something, but can I just say something before you ask me?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "So people always ask me what it was like working with you. And I just say, Jimmy Jam was the nicest guy." And I said, "Exactly, Michael." And I said, "You know the cool thing? When people ask me what it was like working with you, I tell them the exact same thing." He said, "Oh, really?" He said, "Oh, that's so nice. What did you need?" I said, "Well, we sampled Billie Jean." "Oh, just call John Branca. I'll tell him to take care of it and whatever. And everybody's like, "How'd you get that cleared?" And I said, "I guess I'm a nice guy." Damn. So that at the end of the day doesn't mean I'm not going to get along. Doesn't mean we're not going to disagree on things. Yeah. It doesn't mean any of that. I just think nice, kind, all of those things. To me, I wasn't born with it. I was raised like that between my parents, maybe, and probably some of Minnesota nice as the kind of sneaks into there. Hey. But I just think I don't know. I mean, to me, that it doesn't take any more energy to be positive than it does to be negative. And a lot of people wake up looking to be offended, like they almost wake up with an attitude like, "What's going to offend me today?" Or "Who am I going to talk about today in a bad way?" I wake up and I go, "Whose life can I make better today? In some way, in some little way."
I would that's why be remiss if I didn't thank you like very profusely for the fact that you Instagrammed me. And our conversation begins with you saying, "I like your breakdowns," but I was nearly in tears thinking, "Oh, that's a bit much," but like it was one of the most moving things as an artist that the next thing you said was, "I think I got into you and you named one of my songs because of my song, I Need You." And I was like, "I can't believe that you've heard of me for anything but for my music." And like, it was very, very meaningful and moving. So thank you very much. I just think it's important.
And so it's cool because it talks about why we're here today. It's because if I see something, I don't like to leave things unsaid. We talked a little bit about Prince earlier. There were so many things that I felt like I didn't get to see or I didn't get to say to Prince. And I've always tried to make it a point when I see something that I like from somebody, I let them know it. If it's a DM or whatever, I don't even know whether they're going to ever read it or whatever. But I want to let people know when I enjoy something that they're doing. And that's how we met initially and then how we met.
Thank you for being so generous.
The best way. Yeah. I think that's one of the main reasons, other than your God-given talent, that you literally, you and Terry, you guys go from, you know, the band R, the band-driven R&B of the you know, late 70s, early 80s, all the way to the present. Almost nobody else can brag that. And I think that we just are very grateful to a very nice man known as Jimmy Jam. Thank you so much for coming through today. Let's give him a round of applause.
Thank you, Jimmy Jam.
Thank you. Thank you, everybody.
And Luxury, as always, help me in this thing.
Well, I'm producer, DJ, and songwriter Luxury.
And I'm actor, writer, director, and sometimes DJ, Diala Riddle.
And this is One Song. We will see you next time. This episode was produced by Matthew Nelson and Jordan Colling, with engineering from Marcus Hong. Additional production support from Leslie Guam, Charles Childers, and Alicia Shimada. The show is executive produced by Kevin Hart, Ty Randolph, Mike Stein, Brian Smiley, Eric Eddings, and Eric Wilde.
Myrtle Beach is the beach. 60 miles of bright sand, water, and a wealth of wonderful music playing day and night. You can step into a simple beach bar and discover a surprising level of exciting musical talent. A place to kick back and groove to the enticing soundtrack of the most unexpected vacations around. With nothing but good vibes floating through the warm ocean air. Plan your own music-filled trip to America's jukebox at visitmyrtlebeach.com.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.